You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Hello, we recorded this episode before we learned about the death of our friend Kerry Ealy. Kerry'd been with Time Team for decades and has been our kind of Mr. Logistics, really. There's been so many people getting in touch with us through the Time Team membership, through Patreon, and I just wanted to read this from Jill Bray, who's one of our Time Team members, who says this to you, Helen. After hearing the sad news about the wonderful Kerry Ealy, I wondered what your favourite memory of him was.
Well, that's a lovely question. I've got so many memories of Kerry. I think perhaps my favourite one, though, is almost when I didn't know him, because although we started with Time Team at the same time, we shared our first Time Teams. It was the 1998 Live at Borsey in Norfolk, and he was a professional digger. And I found out that he'd been a submariner in a past life, which I think you could tell, you know, he had that kind of deep confidence and kind of poise, that ability to talk to anybody that often comes with people who've been in the services. People then discovered what he could do. He wasn't just a digger. He could do almost anything. But then, you see, he carried on working for Time Team, and I just went back to normal work, and I didn't become a full member of Time Team until 2005. And at that point, I met Kerry again and got to know him a bit better. And my memory of Kerry is probably everybody's favourite memory of Kerry, I think. It's to do with the famous practical joke that was played on John Gator. So I was mostly working in the incident room, and Kerry was often there as well, because he was working on something. He and Henry were working on something. And occasionally I would say, oh, what is that, Kerry? And he'd either say, oh, it's a few broom handles, or he'd say, none of your business, or something like that. And then we were outside filming. I can't even remember where it was, but we were outside filming one day when I became aware of a hush that had descended on the whole field. So probably Land Rover engines had been turned off and so on. And everybody's attention was drawn towards something that was going on with a digger. It was obvious that it was rolling towards something, and John was shouting and running. John Gator was shouting and running. And I was horrified. What on earth's going on? John was running and yelling and running and yelling. And somebody said, it's all right, it's all right. Don't worry, don't worry, just watch. We were all walking over. And by that time, he was in earshot. And I heard him say, that's a £30,000. Oh, no, it's not. As he realised what had been done to him. And Kerry was bent double with laughter. You know, he and Henry had spent months and months and months borrowing the magnetometer, photographing it, measuring it, making it out of broom handles, painting it, putting the wires on, I think from a bicycle or something, making a perfect replica. Then they'd got everybody, all the camera operators, they'd choreographed everything so it would be perfectly done in a bowl of a field, so that everything was laid out beautifully. You could see it, you could film it. It was perfectly like a little ballet. And that epitomises Kerry, that he was an incredibly hard worker, but he liked to work for laughs. and he was incredibly naughty. That's the really the word that you have to sum him up. He was very, very naughty, as well as being very, very brilliant and incredibly reliable. And now that we've lost him after, I mean, he's been ill for a long time, but was still working, still being our rock and our foundation. And now all of a sudden we have lost him, and it's really terrible.
I just want to read a few comments from some other people from Time Team, because Sir Tony Robinson has written about Kerry, saying, "Kerry was my friend. He teased me like a brother about my driving, my archaeological skills, about everything, really. We texted each other most weekends about how rubbish each other's football team was. I respected him deeply and knew I could always rely on him. I wish I'd been more like him, and suspect most of his male and female friends feel the same. I loved him, and so did Lou. We're so sorry he's gone." And this is just a little bit of what Tim Taylor, the creator of Time Team, had to say. And you can read his full comments about Kerry over on Patreon. But this is just the end of his thoughts. "The pleasure of knowing he was there and enjoying his warm humour was, for me, one of the highlights of a Time Team programme. I shall miss him personally and professionally, and I send my profound condolences to his family." So just a couple of thoughts of some people very close to Time Team, part of the Time Team family, and tributes to Kerry have come in from people who knew him and people who didn't, sending their best wishes to his family at what must be a really, really difficult time.
Can I just add one more thing, actually? Because that story of Kerry with the smashed up magnetometer has become so famous that probably it's everybody's favourite memory of Kerry. But I've got one other one, which is quite personal. Really early on, when I started working for Time Team, I was finding things, you know, being away from your family for 3 days at a time when you've got, I think my eldest was something like 9 months old, it's quite difficult. And Kerry was also in the same position with his little daughter, Maya. And Kerry went out of his way to make me feel welcomed and part of the team. So there's one particular moment when I'd got Angus and Theo, my eldest son, who was the little one in the pushchair, to come up to visit because I was missing them. And it was lunchtime, and Kerry took the pot of pureed baby food from me and said, "I'll feed Theo, you go and chat to people." He sat on a little grassy slope with Theo in the pushchair and fed the gunk into Theo's mouth, scraped it off his spoon and put it back in again. And I felt that Kerry was showing me that it was okay to bring your child onto site. It didn't mean that you were not so committed as everybody else. It was okay to be all part of the Time Team family. And that he, as a man, you know, in those days, this was 20 years ago, was quite happy to sit there and feed Theo, and it allowed me to feel much more included and much more okay about being there and having children. He was always concerned to make you feel at home and kind of safe.
Yeah, a really, really remarkable man, and he's going to be so, so missed.
Yes, he really will be. And thank you if you've sent us some kind words about Kerry. It's really appreciated. And now on with our episode.
Yes, hello, welcome along to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Dr. Helen Geek. Here we are once again.
We are indeed, and thank you for joining us this week. Next week we have our Christmas quiz, don't forget, and I am gearing up, ready to, hopefully to repeat my fantastic victory over Derek Pittman that I managed last year.
Yes. So Helen and Derek are going to be going head to head once again. And we're going to put that episode, by the way, on YouTube as well for you to watch as well as listen to. So excited is everyone across sort of time team and all. Yeah, people were very excited about this. So we're like, right, we're going to go all guns blazing.
Because they're putting in their questions, aren't they?
Yes, exactly.
And I must not go out and nobble them. And I hope Derek isn't doing that either.
No, that's it. No influencing, please.
No.
So anyway, that is coming up next week on this podcast. We're doing all the questions, and we've also got Helen's find coming up as well. But let's dive straight in with question number one, and it comes from Michael, who says, I'm curious to know if there are any second generation time team members, so that's offspring of the original team members, who are now working on time team or just in archaeology in general. Now, one name definitely springs to mind, somebody who we've featured on this podcast many times, and I think I know who you're going to say, Helen.
Yeah, I'm going to say Meg Russell, because Miles, her dad, and I were at university together, and he did a few time teams in the olden days. It certainly makes me feel old seeing Meg as a proper grown-up doing proper grown-up things. My goodness, yes. And of course, actually, she's not just a second generation, she's a third generation in a way, because Miles inspired his mum, I think it was, to take up archaeology too. So there are a few of those dynasties around. There's also the dynasty of the Burleys at Vindolanda. I think they're on to their third or even fourth generation of archaeologists all digging on the same site. But most of us, I think, successfully put our children off, because we've all brought the odd teenager down to work as a runner or a camera assistant. I mean, Mick's son, my children have come down, and we've had producers and directors and so on who bring their troublesome teenagers as well. And we hope that they'll decide that it's a fun career. But I don't think it's resulted in any actually deciding to join in. But, you know, when I was thinking about this, I thought that the list of people who have archaeologists as parents is actually quite interesting. Even if they don't go on to be archaeologists themselves, did you know that Julie Christie, the actress, her mother, Rosemary Christie, was an industrial archaeologist with a specialism in lighthouses?
Oh, right.
If you
a buy specialism in lighthouses.
Book, yeah. The standard book is Haig and Christie on lighthouses. And apparently Julie Christie used to turn up on excavations. Her mother mainly worked in South Wales. She was known for popping into excavations in South Wales, and apparently she always caused a bit of a stir.
Well, you'd imagine that she probably would. I suppose, the it's likely to happen at some point that somebody who is an archaeologist goes on to have a child who then becomes famous, and that is just sort of what they do. But it is just all very interesting. So there
it
you
is,
go.
The
sort of the time team family has many tentacles that spread right the way along, and continues to do so. Whether they want to be involved or not, they often find themselves roped in one way or another. Michael, thank you very much for the question. Here comes question number two, just ahead of Helen's find, and this comes from Fiona, who's been listening to the back catalogue of the podcast, which you can do, of course, at your leisure. Fiona says, I've just been listening to one of your podcasts from July about dinosaurs. I think, from memory, I asked something along the lines of why aren't people who investigate dinosaurs not archaeologists, why are they paleontologist, and I think it was something to do with that. Anyway, Fiona was listening to that episode. A couple of questions popped into my mind, says Fiona. Do archaeologists ever help police solve crimes? Well, where were you when we were doing an episode with with Stuart Ainsworth on heritage crime? You know the answer to that. What's the cutoff time for a body to have died and not be considered modern? That's a good question. And as DNA testing is becoming more advanced, can you test for genetic conditions such as epilepsy, which have had a genetic cause but would not be visible when examining bones? Can I just at this point mention Hitler? Because they've recently done genetic tests on Adolf Hitler's remains and discovered that he was prone to have certain conditions that doesn't prove that he had them. It just proves that he had a likelihood to have had these conditions. Now, presumably, that is a test that can be done on all sorts of different remains, presumably ones that have been in the ground an awful lot longer than, you know, 80 years or so.
Yes, but it's controversial, isn't it? It's this, what's it called? It's polygenic risk analysis, which means that they're taking a combination of different genes and saying, well, you might have a risk of developing this and you might have a risk of developing that. I'm not aware that that's used because, in a way, archaeologically, it shouldn't be that important. What we're more interested in is a kind of yes-no question. Did this person definitely have that, rather than risk factors? So to do these whole genome tests is in fact quite easy now. You end up seeing things like ancient Egyptian whole genomes being analysed. And when you think about the insults that have happened to that tissue over the years, the embalming, the mummification, the dry climate, the just the sheer weight of years, and they can still get enough DNA to do a whole genome. It is incredible what modern genetics can do. So yes, Fiona, in theory, you can test for genetic conditions that would have a binary genetic cause but wouldn't be visible when examining bones. So you can look for things like the gene for Huntington's disease and see how that has moved around the population. But actually, what people do more is they look for the genome of an infectious agent, and the classic there is Yersinia pestis, which causes bubonic plague. So for years and years and years, there's been all sorts of discussions as to whether things like the Black Death actually were caused by bubonic plague. And there was a bit of a fashion, I don't know, in the 1990s, I think, to say, no, it wasn't bubonic plague. It must have been something else, because you got the Black Death in Iceland and you had no rats in Iceland. So there were suggestions of anthrax or this, that and the other. But eventually we could do the genetic analysis. The genome of Yersinia pestis has been found in, not always in the bones, of course, but in things like tooth plaque, all sorts of very interesting little things that survive that you wouldn't normally value, except that they trap DNA. And it's been discovered that the Black Death victims in Iceland, it really was Yersinia pestis, and we've got to rethink our ideas about how plague spreads. It's not all to do with rats.
All right, so that's quite a bit that we can learn there. The other bits of the question here from Fiona are about things like helping the police to solve crime. So this is using similar, I mean, this is, I suppose, the DNA stuff. Much of the forensic stuff may have been developed for work with the police, and that's a way that the police are kind of help archaeology in a way, or that sort of science that's used a lot by the police help archaeology. And what about the other way around, these archaeological techniques that are used by the police to help solve crime? Now, with Stuart, we were talking about heritage crimes. This is sort of theft, things like that. What about the sort of more sciencey skeletons and bodies in the ground sort of side of it, you know, the more gruesome side of crime?
Yes, and that's known as forensic archaeology, and there are several master's courses in that now. You can actually qualify as a forensic archaeologist, and they work with the police. But because it's a very specialised subject, because you have to know as much about the legal system and how the police and the criminal justice systems work as you do about archaeological techniques, they tend to have their own forensic archaeologists rather than call someone in from outside. So it's less that an archaeologist is working with the police. It's that these days the police have their own archaeologists, almost like we're beginning to have our own police in the heritage crime experts. But the techniques were largely developed by Margaret Cox, who was Time Team's osteoarchaeologist. She worked in the former Yugoslavia excavating mass graves when those were exhumed after the conflict in the former Yugoslavia, and brought all of the archaeological techniques she could to bear on finding out how they died, who they were, and so on and so forth. And that is how largely how forensic archaeology began in its early days. So that goes back to Time Team as well. Margaret said that it's a very it's a very emotionally difficult job to do, and that actually there's a high burnout rate and you need to be a very special kind of person to do it.
Yeah, I'm not surprised at all, because it's, and even within archaeology, I mean, there's lots of, we get questions all the time from people who are talking about the ethics of, you know, what you do when you find a body and whether or not it's right to excavate it. And you can imagine that the more recent the body that you are dealing with, the more emotionally difficult that is going to be to handle.
That's true. And it's not just that a burial is very recent. It's also how a person has died. So if you're dealing with violence and conflict, it's really difficult. Whereas actually quite a lot of archaeologists find excavating a person who's peacefully died and been peacefully laid to rest, it's actually quite it's a caring act. And there is one archaeologist famously who wrote an account of how 10 days after her mother died, she dreamt she was excavating her grave and that it was a healing and a caring and a looking after experience, that the dream helped her come to terms with her mother's loss rather than anything else.
I think there's so many ways that you could take this question and continue this conversation. And perhaps, Fiona, we need to revisit your questions, some of the things you've talked about, because we could also go on to talk about lots of different disciplines and how they have, we've begged, borrowed and stolen different things to help archaeology, in the same way as, you know, you hear a lot, don't you, about how our explorations in space and stuff we do in the International Space Station has given us technology that we use on Earth. I bet we use some space tech somewhere in archaeology that we could discuss.
We also use a lot of space theory, space philosophy, and how philosophy in general interacts with archaeology, and how sociological theory and literary theory and so on. I think let's hang on to that idea about space, Martin, because there are people who do the archaeology of the moon. Oh. Maybe we could interview them.
Moon archaeologists. Mm. This is, yeah. Oh, this is great. And I can do my Brian Cox impression as well. Fantastic. Okay, let's pause on the questions for now, though. We will return to them in a moment. First, though, here's Helen's find, where Helen brings you an item, an object with a really interesting historical and archaeological past to sort of tantalise you. You might remember about a month ago, we were talking on this podcast about Movember, and we were mm-hmm. talking about moustaches. And what are we talking about this time?
Yes, this is an object known as a moustache. And, well, you have to go and have a look at it to see, you'll see immediately why they're called moustaches.
Yes, and I will put the link to this object, which is on the Portable Antiquity Scheme. I'll put the link to it in the description of this podcast, so you can immediately go and have a look. If you were to do that, yeah, you would see this thing. I mean, it does just look like a moustache. You could imagine it.
Yes,
it's quite an ornate moustache, I guess, a very impressive moustache that would be just under somebody's nose on their top lip there.
That's right, but it is very small for a moustache. It's just 5 and a bit centimeters across, so it's a tiny but perfect moustache. These objects all consist of two halves of a moustache kind of curving out, and together they make what you might think of as a kind of rather beautiful walrus moustache, perhaps. And they also, each half has grooves, so they look like a walrus moustache that has been combed. I mean, you can't get any better than that, and no one's ever put a better name on them than moustache, because we have absolutely no idea how they were used. The only clue really is that these two halves are always joined by a short and narrow bar which has a vertical hole through it. So if you are placing it under your nose, that the hole goes vertically down through it. Now this one was recorded just last month by one of my colleagues in Surrey, and it was found near Winchester in Hampshire, but it's just the last one in a long line that goes back to the Salisbury Hoard, which is an absolute cause célèbre. The Salisbury Hoard is such an exciting story that, again, it deserves a full podcast to itself. I haven't got time to tell you all about it now, Martin. I mean, the book about it reads like a detective story. But essentially, what you need to know is that The Salisbury hoard was a huge hoard of Bronze Age objects, mainly Bronze Age objects, but it also includes a few items that come from every century over more than 2,000 years, right up until it was finally buried in the Iron Age. So it is a rather extraordinary set of objects, but it's also absolutely useless for dating any of them, because most things are Bronze Age, but then some things are late Bronze Age, some things are early Iron Age, some things are middle Iron Age, some things are late Iron Age, and we have no evidence to show which era this one fits into. Now, because they're such lovely little things, Iron Age experts all look at them and say, oh yes, they're so beautiful, they must be Iron Age. But Bronze Age experts also look at them and say, oh no, they are so beautiful, they must be Bronze Age. Everybody wants to claim them as their own. So we now have about 80 of them on the Portable Antiquities Scheme database, but still none has yet been found in a proper sealed archaeological context. So I'm deducing from that that they tend to be more lost than thrown away. We're developing a bit of a kind of theory of loss for things on the Portable Antiquities Scheme. What kinds of objects are more likely to be lost than discarded? So they're things, they're precious items, they're small items, they're things that are loose and attached to the outside of things, like sword pyramids from the Anglo-Saxon period or seal matrices from the medieval period. These things are also hardly ever seen in archaeological contexts, but they're often found by metal detectorists. So one of the suggestions has been that it's part of weaponry, maybe a dagger pommel. But the thing is that none has ever been found in place on a dagger. So we're just, it's another of these, you know, experts baffled by extraordinary find. And I am aware that I keep bringing these things to your attention, that we don't know what they're for. And I absolutely resolve that we're going to occasionally have an object where I do know what it's for and I can tell you all about it. But this is not it. These are so mysterious, but partly because of their name and their cute little appearance, they're a very well-known class of unidentified object, and they're just so lovely. I thought I'd like to show you one.
I suppose because it is called a moustache, you know, because people do refer to it as a moustache, it's very difficult to not see it as somebody just wanting to make something that looks like a funny moustache.
Yeah, and we always photograph them this way up, with the drooping ends.
Yeah, because it might not be that way at all. It could be in any...
No.
And I love as well, on the Portable Antiquities Scheme website, somebody's put the class, and its class is moustache-shaped object.
Yes, because otherwise they just get lost in the unidentified object. You've got to make sure you've got that word moustache in there. That's the way that we search for them. So in the search bar, just type in moustache. Go to Bronze Age or Iron Age and the filters down the side and you can see the whole lot.
Yeah, I'm going to have to do that immediately.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Lost Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey, Bowen, it's gift season.
Ugh, stressing me out. Why are the people I love so hard to shop for?
Probably because they only make boring gift guides that are totally uninspired. Except for the guide we made.
In partnership with Marshalls, where premium gifts meet incredible value.
It's giving gifts! With categories like best gifts for the mom whose idea of a sensible walking shoe is a stiletto.
Or best gifts for me that were so thoughtful I really shouldn't have.
Check out the guide on Marshalls.com.
And gift the good stuff at Marshalls.
Now, there's less than 10 days to go until Christmas, so I hope you've all managed to start on your Christmas puddings and begin to get things wrapped up and put under the tree.
Yes, not long to go. The panic is very well and truly here. And if, like me, you haven't got all your presents yet and you're kind of scrabbling around for ideas, Time Team can help. There is a comprehensive selection of unique present ideas for Time Team fans, for history and archaeology buffs. It's all there over on the Time Team official shop.
Yes, now I really like the beer glass that's in the shop under, I think, drinking accessories. It's got a lovely curvy shape. It sits very nicely in the hand, and it's a very sought after object among all Time Team people.
Yes, and I think a favourite as well, I imagine, of John Gator. Who,
yes, probably has several.
I would imagine so. Yeah, so if you want that or anything indeed from the stocking fillers collection on the shop, if you just go and have a look there, because there's a little thank you, a little Merry Christmas from the team. You can redeem a limited time offer, 10% of all the items that are featured in the stocking fillers collection in the shop. That runs until the end of December. Use the code TTChristmas at checkout. Christmas, all one word. That offer, single use only, can't be combined with other membership offers. Standard shop T's and C's apply.
And we should also mention that you can, of course, give the gift of Time Team, because Time Team membership is available to purchase as a gift subscription directly on our Patreon membership page. And for that, you just go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
Yes, and I should mention as well at this point, 7 days of Time Team membership, the free trial is available still now. So if you want to kind of give it a go yourself and you're not a Time Team member at the moment, you want to kind of find out what extras that you get, now is the time to do that, because it's 7 days completely free for you. One of the things you get is you get the opportunity to ask a question to Helen on this podcast, and that is exactly what Clancy has done. Thank you, Clancy, for this question. Clancy says, these may have already been asked, but what exactly is the digging season? And would it be possible, as someone from another country, to come volunteer at a dig for a couple of weeks and then head back? Or do volunteers generally sign up for the whole season with a dig? I would say this sort of question, Clancy, is the sort of question the question we probably get asked the most, because people love coming along and supporting us on digs that we do. And you do, as Time Team members, you do get the opportunity to do just that. It's incredibly sought after, as you might imagine. But there are ways and means that you can help us out on digs, and you can come and see them, aren't there?
Yeah, and to answer the question, Clancy, well, really, the digging season is the time of year that it's practical and that it's efficient to be outside. Obviously, development-led excavation, you have to do that all the year round, because you have to fit in with building and development. But if you're doing a research excavation, or if you're doing Time Teams, you do not want it to get dark at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and you definitely don't want it to be rained off half the time. But it isn't exactly a fixed season, like kind of asparagus season or whatever. You can fix your season where you want it. So you can have a 3-week season at Easter, or you can do 8 weeks in May and June, or whatever fits in with your project. As to whether it's possible to volunteer for a few weeks or whether you have to sign up for the whole season, well, that completely depends on the project. And some really complex projects, they don't have the wherewithal to train too many volunteers. So they can sometimes say that they'll only take people who can sign up for at least a certain number of weeks. And really, you just have to look around for the project that's right for you. And once you've made friends with your project, then, and once you've been trained up, of course, it's easier to come back for a day here or a week there, because you're already a volunteer. But finding that first project, that's the key.
Yeah, and I mean, I know that the several organisations, I won't necessarily mention them now, but there are several organisations that exist that kind of offer archaeology sort of holidays, sort of thing, where you can, and I know Matt Williams was recently involved in a dig like that, where people, you know, you pay money, but then you get the opportunity to go and help out on a dig. Now, at Time Team, we don't charge you as such to be a volunteer, you know, although, you know, you very kindly help us and support us with the with your Time Team membership, of course. But we do offer that in a way, don't we? And we've done that at places like Sutton Hoo when we were there This year, we had a lot of time team members who we kind of gave training to and helped us in test pits and in the main site. Where we can, we do like to offer that. But you've got, you know, it's dependent on the site, isn't it, Helen, as to which ones kind of need a bit of volunteer help and which ones don't?
Yes, exactly. Some places find it easier to take volunteers. Some situations it is much harder. And also it depends on the volunteer. Every volunteer has a skill or many skills that we can use. It's just applying them to the right place. So that if somebody has a particular ability to, you know, like they've got a background in geology, then perhaps there's less point in using them somewhere sandy and better to use them somewhere where we're going to need their expertise on building stones. Some people come for a week to do very little and find that they find it very hard to leave because their skills are so useful. We keep calling on them week in, week out, year in, year out.
Yeah. And we will continue to do that. Clancy, if this is something that you're interested in, and I'm assuming that it is, my advice really, if you want to certainly do stuff with Time Team, is just keep your eye on your Patreon feed, because Time Team members get notified about this stuff when we have got opportunities available. And this is exactly what we did with Sutton Hoo. We put out messages saying, look, if you're interested in this, get in touch with us. And then there was a process by which we selected people who were able to come along, because as you can imagine, it is very, very popular, and we can't offer it to absolutely everybody who wants to come, especially people who obviously might struggle to get to us because they have to travel a very long way. But keep your eye on it. And if you do want to do something maybe more local to where you are or something not with Time Team, there are opportunities. Contact your local archaeology club or look for these paid for kind of archaeology experiences that you can do as well. There's plenty of opportunities to kind of get involved and get your hands dirty, quite literally. Clancy, thank you very much for that question. Let's move on to the final one, and it comes from Joanne, who says, with the successful results of the Vesuvius Challenge, where they've been able to use modern technology to virtually unroll and read some of the papyrus scrolls buried and charred in the 79 AD volcanic eruption, of course, Pompeii, all that, will excavation efforts be revived to see if they can find more scrolls? And this goes back, I think, to a conversation that you and I had, feels like, I think, ages ago now, where we were talking about the point at which you purposely don't do an excavation because you think that maybe technology might come along to help you out and make it easier for you a lot later. And I remember you referencing something like, we don't try and unroll that scroll because it might be in the future that we don't even have to try and unroll it because digital technology will be able to read that scroll in its rolled up form at some point in the future. And maybe the future is now.
maybe it is. But and for something like Pompeii, of course, we'd have to have Dr. Sophie Hay back on to talk about that. But I wonder whether she might say that it's just one of those tiny little elements in the design of an excavation, that the excavation is looking at everything in the round. And maybe the idea that you could read the scrolls might mean that an area that was thought to be a library or a record office might be a priority in a way that it wasn't in the past. But it is certainly, as you say, Martin, it's certainly influencing the way that people work in finds, in that if we get a tightly rolled up piece of lead or gold that looks as if it might have been a cursed tablet or a lamella, as it's known, these Roman inscriptions in gold that are rolled up. In the past, we might have asked a conservator to unroll it, but now we don't want to do that because the rolled up scroll is so evocative when you look at it. You want to put it like that into a museum display, but you also want to know what it says. So we're leaving them until we can use this technology to read them without unrolling them. And at the moment, I don't think anybody has done that for something on lead or on gold. And if we could, it would be very costly. So it may be that we're not able to do it because at the moment we haven't managed to find the right grant to allow us to do it. But during the last few years, more and more of these scrolls of lead or gold have ended up in museums not unrolled. Unrolled, if that's the term.
Rolled, you could say.
Rolled, in fact. Yes, two negatives make a positive. Still rolled up. And although, in a way, you know, it's terribly exciting, we'd be able to have it both on display and unrolled, it's quite annoying at the moment because we're not reading them. And I really do want to get on with this imaging. I want to find the money from somewhere, but we can't do it until we've got enough to make it worthwhile.
There must be a way that it can be done. I mean, if they're starting to be able to do it with the paper stuff, I'm sure it's only a matter of time, surely, before we can.
Yes,
start
but to... the thing is that we know it's there on the papyrus scrolls. We know that there's writing on them, and you'll get a result. Whereas with the metal ones, we don't actually know. They could just be scrap that's been rolled up. So that's another tantalising problem.
Yeah, it'd be quite embarrassing as well, wouldn't it, if we've been displaying all these rolled up scrolls thinking that they hold some important information and it turns out it's just a bit of old scrap metal that's we're putting it in all our museums going, so what could it possibly say? Nothing.
So you do want a dozen or so of them so that at least you've got a fighting chance that one will have some writing on it.
Yeah. Good. That is a good question. Good set of questions, actually, on the podcast today. Thank you very much for suggesting them. This is what you get as one of the many things you get if you are a Time Team member. We really, really need your support with Time Team. It's how we do all of the archaeology that we do. It's how we keep bringing you episodes of Time Team. We can't do it without the generous support of Time Team members. And so you bung us a little bit of money, and in return, we do archaeology. We make these programs for you. And as a thank you, we give you extra stuff. So we give you the opportunity, for example, to ask questions. We also have masterclasses for you. We have extended interviews. There's behind-the-scenes stuff as well. You get to see 3D models. There's so much for you to explore and enjoy as a Time Team member. And right now, we're giving you the opportunity to try that for 7 days. We have a 7-day free trial. You can go and find out more about that by visiting the website. It's patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
And don't forget that next week is our Christmas quiz, when I'm going to be taking on Derek in a rematch of last year.
And how are you feeling about that now? Have you been swatting up?
Well, I am always a bit nervous because, you know, Derek is a head of department at Bournemouth University, and I'm just
this is a clash of the titans here.
And it's of course very difficult to revise and mug up because you don't know what you're going to be asked, but I'm feeling quietly confident.
Okay, well, we will find out next week. And yeah, all the questions, by the way, for that come from, well, in fact, some of them come from Time Team members. Thank you if you're one of those. But some of them also come from other Time Team faces, some of which you will know, you know, people in the Time Team family. So some of which you will know. I think Stuart's got a question. I think John Gator has got a question. And then there's some faces that you may not have seen because they're the behind-the-scenes people, like our director Emily has got a question, our producer Karen's got a question. So loads of people kind of from the Time Team family, including Time Team members, getting involved in the quiz. We are bringing that to you next week, which will be Christmas Eve. 23rd of December. If you want to watch that, it'll be available on both YouTube and to listen to wherever you get your podcasts. But for now, thank you very much for listening, and we'll speak to you next week on the next edition, the Christmas quiz edition of the Time Team podcast. Bye-bye.
This holiday season, reach for the one butter that never disappoints, Kerrygold. Made with milk from grass-fed cows on Irish family farms, it's rich, creamy, and perfect for baking. Whether browning butter for cookies or crafting the flakiest pie crust, Kerrygold's high butterfat content makes all the difference in flavor and texture. Holiday treats will taste extraordinary.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.